The Jane Carroll Show is live Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, and available anytime on your favorite apps and at thejanecarrollshow.com.
Shall we begin?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Right about now.
She's the First Lady of Talk Radio, and she knows politics. Want to take on Jane Carroll? We highly encourage you. Toll free, 888-314-0440. The Jane Carroll Show.
Please listen carefully.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Jane Carroll Show. As you know, we broadcast nationally, but we broadcast from the epicenter of dysfunctional cities, Portland, Oregon. Except tonight, we have somebody that might actually know more about a city that is even worse than Portland, Oregon, hard as that may be to comprehend. And he's from Chicago originally, and he is somebody that is talking about what the heck is going on there, how we can avoid, other people can avoid it, and what can be done to fix it. He does it with great clarity and passion for a city that he calls it his book, What's Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. And I think it's very well done. And it talks about the failing courts, the schools, the horrible finances, the ongoing Black exodus, and purposes to rescue plan for this emblematic American city. Welcome, Matt Rosenberg, to the Jane Carroll Show. Hi, Matt. I love Chicago, and this breaks my heart. Your story breaks my heart.
Good to be with you, Jane. And same here. And the thing is, there's a heavy duality here, is the word I use to describe it. This is a city that still has greatness within it, but it's been overwhelmed by extremely poor governance and just a rotten politics that, among other things, is infused with what I call racial essentialism. But everything is broken. It's not just the awful mantra of systemic racism that our mayor, Lori Lightfoot, uses to explain every problem in the city. It's that the kids are not getting educated in the public schools. It's that the Cook County court system is bound and determined to let arrestees just charged with violent crimes out on no cash or low cash bail. And many of them go out and commit the same types of violent crimes all over again before they even face trial for the first one. It's a city where the corruption is, you know, legendary and historic, but gives rise to rigged rules of governance, like elections held in odd numbered years in the early months of the year so that nobody really shows up to vote, just one third of the electorate. And they ought to peg the local elections to the federal presidential elections when 70% of registered voters turn out, but they don't want that. It's a city where three of our aldermen are currently under federal indictment for new corruption charges. You know, the horror show never stops. And then, of course, there's the day-to-day violence on the streets, which we've always had, but it's just gotten dramatically worse. And so it's really not safe to be out and about. People are scared to come out of their homes, and that is a really dire situation.
Yeah, when people are afraid, and of course, we hear the accounts of little children getting killed in their homes with stray gunfire, et cetera, in Chicago. A lot of people thought that Barack Obama, being from Chicago, when he became president, might focus on it. He didn't do a thing.
No, and I don't know how fair it is to expect that. He had to be president of the whole nation, but no. And more than that, even, you know, increasingly our urban political elite here has been one of color, you know, is the term that's used, meaning basically Blacks and Latinos. And our history here, of course, is that the Irish ran it, and the Italians and the Poles, and they had their own little sweet deals and back-scratching arrangements And you would think that considering the problems facing the African American and Latino communities, that when people of those races began to take over in the positions of power, and not just in local government, but also our congressional seats and many others, our elected prosecutor, our chief judge who's appointed, our county elected officials, are very, very many of them are Black or Latino. And they really adopted the ways of the old white ethnics in terms of the self-dealing and the corruption, and they've made excuses. Anytime anything goes wrong, when the schools aren't working, when the courts aren't working, well, it's the white man's fault, always. You know, it's always toxic whiteness to blame. And so there's this great reluctance to focus on the role of parents. That's really, Jane, I think, one of the big elephants in the room. Another elephant in the room is, you know, crime and punishment, right? We have this myth that there's been mass incarceration. I mean, last year, 0.6% of the American populace did time in a federal or state prison. 0.6%. You know, it was somewhat higher in the 90s and late 80s, but we've never really had mass incarceration. We used to have punishment for crime. Now, if you don't get let out on bond to commit a bunch more crimes before you face trial, you get a sweet plea deal and you get probation. You know, for a sex offense committed on the public transit, that actually happened. And the guy went out and did it again. Young man got probation for a carjacking because he was a juvenile. Then he turned 18 and went out and did another carjacking, punched an old man in the head, and the man died. And it was a 73-year-old Black U.S. veteran and grandfather buying groceries before he went to his daughter's house to make dinner for his daughter and his granddaughters. And always now the victims are Black and the perpetrators are almost entirely of color. So Black-on-Black violence is this other elephant in the room, and you're not allowed to discuss it. You're only allowed to talk about stuff like this when a white cop does something to a Black young man. So we've got just a horrible public discourse here, and I fear that that's reflected in many of our other big cities.
Yeah, I think it clearly is. Now, we got to see Chicago on stage with its legal system and its corruption and its bias, racial bias. During the Jussie Smollett case, which, you know, people tracked, and it was just, and the role of your prosecution team was just ridiculous. The whole thing was just, it was like a bad episode of Law and Order.
It was a real black eye for the city. Now I should, and you, I'm sure you know this, Jane, he is going to face trial. Probably sometime next year, I'm guessing. Our prosecutor, our county prosecutor, Kim Fox, who remarkably was reelected with something like 60% of the vote last year, which also tells you a lot about, you know, voters not taking charge. She, you know, removed herself from the case, but then her assistants basically dropped the original charges against Smollett for allegedly faking a hate crime against himself. And there was a hue and cry. Chicago had gotten a huge black eye in the international press because people believed it was real. Kamala Harris was one of many high-profile people who decried, you know, the horrible racist hate crime. But charges were brought again by a special prosecutor. So he may face justice yet, but the whole thing showed, you know, the willingness to sort of backflip our way out of a tight spot. And it just sort of shows the emphasis on victimization. And that is the very same thing that our mayor is using to explain the higher murder rate, which afflicts Black communities, to explain health disparities, to explain the ghost neighborhoods. And I walked through much of the South Side, Jane. I moved back here last year. You know, I lived here 30 years, right? So this is kind of the setup. I lived here 30 years, you know, from 64 to 94, from the time I was just a little kid, a first grader, to the time I was in my early mid-30s. And, you know, it's been a great place. I saw things just going haywire last year, as in other cities, but especially here. 18 people killed in one day on May 31st, 2020. It was just nuts. So I came back and I moved in and I went deep into the South Side to talk to Black people in their homes and workplaces. And there's some good news here. And I do want to emphasize that there's good news hidden between the cracks in a lot of our cities that are malfunctioning. And the good news is often in the African-American community. It turns out, you know, this has never changed. Conservative values have always lived in Black and Latino communities. You don't read about it in your daily newspaper, in the Tribune, the Sun-Times, or the Oregonian, or Willamette Week, or our, and I'm familiar with, you know, those sorts of papers, or you don't read about it in our alternative weekly here, but it's there if you want to go out and find it. So there are two-parent families, entrepreneurs, raising their kids strictly and right. There are Christian homeschooling parents in the Black community in Chicago's South Side. There are ex-convicts who are on the up and up, working hard, running their own package delivery companies. The Amazon economy has actually been pretty good for folks like ex-convicts. And you can get a micro-lending loan for $20,000 or $40,000 a pop, buy one or two Sprinter vans and start your own package delivery service. And they don't care if you're an ex-con. They care if you show up on time and deliver all your packages. So you can make good money, although the hours are long. So there are all kinds of success stories here. And we just need to do more, though, with job training and vocational training. And there are some other people doing other things that I was able to write about too in my book. And I won't go off on a long discourse, but there are churches and nonprofits training, you know, Black female electricians. It's fantastic stuff, you know, and we need to shine a light on those success stories and show that there are ways out of this despair and this madness.
Your miracle mile. Is it as bad as they say it is?
Well, you know, I was walking through there with my wife just this morning. We're coming from a radio station downtown, actually. This morning, it was not horrible. But overall, yes, in the last year and a half, an awful lot of really, really dark stuff has been happening on Michigan Avenue, our high-end downtown shopping district. That's like, you know, the most emblematic, you know, mile and a half you're ever going to find in Chicago. And it's beautiful. You know, there are 100-story buildings. There are fancy retailers, specialty shops. There's Lake Michigan at the end of it. You know, I grew up walking up and down Michigan Avenue in the 60s and 70s. It's a magical place. And now, unfortunately, you've got guys walking into high-end boutiques and clearing $40,000 worth of purses off the shelves, you know, with guns drawn. You've got guys, armed robbery crews, jumping out of carjacked SUVs, dressed in black masks and all black clothes, relieving a dozen people of their wallets and phones in one fell swoop. You know, there's random stabbings. There's even killings. There was a guy with a hammer on the CTA train going at people, you know, and it turned out he had prior arrests for attacking bus passengers with knives, you know, and the court. So again, the court system, revolving door every step of the way. So things have gotten bad on Michigan Avenue. There are more empty stores now than there used to be. And of course, with the blockade of cargo ships at sea, you know, it's not like people are going to be able to go out and buy Christmas presents. So I wouldn't be shocked if the robberies intensified as the holidays drew closer. So it's just really, really rotten. And I think it starts with elected leaders calling out the community to do better, because every one of these young men, and it's almost always a young man, you know, they had a mother and a father, you know? So I think we almost need pre-parental parenting education, you know, that whole thing. Like I heard today about a program where they have middle schoolers carry an egg around for a week. Think about it, right? And you can't let the egg break. You know, that's actually brilliant to me. And impress upon them the seriousness. You know, we should be treating each child like it was that egg. We should be introducing vocabulary early. We should make sure there are two, and the we is all of us. So there need to be two parents in each house. There's a vast social science literature on this. So there's just, frankly, a dishonesty and an unwillingness to face up to some very basic facts that I believe are at the root of the trouble we're seeing in San Francisco, in Philadelphia, in Portland, in Seattle, where, of course, white parents bear responsibility for some of these nut bars, you know, from Eugene and Portland.
But, you know, you talk about the contrasting, you have lights of optimism in your book talking about the Chicago way and how it did, one of your critiques says you say you write in the style of Mike Royko. Well, that's quite a compliment, actually, I think, in terms of what you achieve, because it makes it an entertaining and a passionate read as well. And you know of what you speak, you know of your city you love, and you'd like it to return to its days of grandeur, because it's Portland's very much like that. We're not as big. We are a white city for the most part. We do have a vibrant African American community, but we've been teaching critical race theory in our Portland public schools for over a decade. Portland is a very leftist city. It's very leftist. Everybody on the Portland City Council is far, far left. We ended up reelecting our mayor, who became a national joke, as has yours, Mayor Ted Wheeler, because when it came down to the runoff between the top two candidates, the other one was a member of Antifa. So we either were going to have the anarchists running the city or a guy that kowtows to them. And we voted to keep the guy that kowtowed him. It's that bad. The options aren't there. It's either, you know, one far left person of one skin color versus another far left person of another skin color. But they're all ideologically one and the same. Nobody runs that has a chance. I live in a precinct, a district, a congressional district, a House and Senate district for legislature. Republicans don't even run. They haven't run in years because they cannot win. It's pretty, and Portland is a beautiful city. It's used to be a family friendly city. Now it's a dangerous city. Our murder rate is up. We have the same problem here. We arrest them. They're out 2 hours later. Well over a decade, it's not been against the law to throw feces and urine at the police. Yeah, it's inconvenient, but they emasculate the police. They don't support the police. The police are the bad guys. Portland is a joke.
And I think what goes around comes around. And, you know, for the last 27 years, after 30 years in Chicago, my wife and I have been living in Seattle. You know, I've seen a lot of the very same thing there. I've always come back to Chicago. And as I said, I came back last year. I'm back here now. I think that what we're seeing is, you know, people are moving south and southwest, and they're moving to the inland west, as you know. If you've got the money, you know, places like Bend, despite the, you know, almost growth on steroids there, in percentage terms. Places like that have never looked better. Boise, as you probably know, is experiencing dramatic growth. Montana, after COVID hit, places like Billings and Missoula are starting to get almost overrun. Refugees from New York, from Chicago, from all over. And then you've got, you know, Phoenix, Dallas, Jacksonville, and, you know, Tennessee is on fire. I see this. And even Louisville, which ain't perfect, but it sure ain't Chicago. So in Tennessee, people are moving to Chattanooga and Nashville like you wouldn't believe. And what you get in all of these places, and I've heard this from folks on the south side of Chicago, you know, the crime and the taxes are chasing them out. So you've got a much easier way of living, much more affordable. The public schools work. The streets are much, much safer. Business regulatory environment is you know, a lot more moderate. And so it's kind of a no-brainer for a lot of people. So right now there doesn't seem any hope politically. I think we need a bottom-up revolution in Chicago where there is a sort of a rebranding of a reform party. You've got what I know you would probably call the Marxist wing of the Democratic Party. They call themselves socialists. Interestingly, when they have to identify their party affiliation, many of them still identify as Democrats. In official voter surveys, are six Chicago socialists on the city council. Four of them also identify as Democrats. So that does go to the point that you've made previously. You know, if they can make inroads, if the socialists can grow in Chicago from one member on the city council before 2019 to six after our 2019 municipal elections, which is what happened here, that should send a signal up the flagpole to the electorate. You know, basically, hey, the 66% of you who aren't voting in local elections, guys, you kind of need to step up. And hey, it might help if you had an idea, you know, or a movement, or even your own party that's not the socialists. And so I say in Chicago, where we have this long history of really upstanding and sometimes moderately effective good government groups. I worked for one actually once when I was 19 on a really interesting undercover investigation of shakedowns of small businesses by corrupt city inspectors with a great newspaper and a great nonprofit. We have this tradition here of reform efforts, right? Why not start a Chicago Reform Party, even though technically our elections are nonpartisan? That didn't stop the socialists from getting six people on the city council. So start a new party called the Chicago Reform Party and have an actual agenda that talks about the stuff that people are talking about in the hood. And then you got to find some money, people, and you got to fund a dramatic voter registration drive, I think. And you've got to somehow, even though it won't happen in the schools, although I wish it would, you've got to start to teach civic engagement again, because people feel right now like it makes no difference. They're going to do what they're going to do. And the perverse thing here, Jane, that I've noticed is that for the urban progressives that are running our cities into the ground, that actually failure is their political success strategy. Because think about it. If things stay rotten, people won't vote. And only, you know, a small handful, and it's usually public employee union members and maybe employees of large favored contractors. So the old reliables come out to vote in the same old people, and the rest of folks say, why bother? Everything's going to stink anyway. So it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling cycle, and I think it suits the office holders fine, because they just want to, yeah, they want to hold power. That's what they want to do. They don't want to fix things.
No, and they don't, and they kowtow to the left because they're more afraid of them, and because they'll, you know, they intimidate them. They really do. They're afraid mm-hmm. of them. They assault them. They walk up in the room in restaurants. They, Ted Wheeler, the mayor of Portland, they were outside when he, before his wife had enough and divorced him. You know, she had kids at home. They were outside on the lawns all night screaming epitaphs at him. And, you know, he was kowtowing to them. I mean, it was absurd. Your mayor is a laughing stock as well. She's not solving any problems. Of course, if you say that, you're a racist. So it's right.
Yeah, and it was really discouraging because I've got to let your listeners know, Lori Lightfoot was not a washout up until this point. She was an impressive person with an impressive background, and she campaigned like a real tiger. Particularly as an anti-corruption candidate, and that's been a real scourge on our city over the years. Even since the 1860s when the city was founded, we've had corruption right from the get-go. She actually worked earlier in the 2000s as a federal prosecutor in the late 90s and helped put corrupt Chicago aldermen in jail, literally. As a prosecutor, she campaigned on a robust platform of term limits, two-term limits for the city council and mayor. She campaigned on a clean redistricting, letting an independent commission draw the new lines for our 50 city wards, which is way too many local legislative districts for our city council. That's another issue. She campaigned on another anti-corruption issue of not letting any one alderman decide on development decisions in their own ward. But, you know, the hive mind of the whole council would have to decide development and zoning proposals. Don't just defer to the local alderman, because in the past that has led to shakedowns, bribes, literally. And it only makes sense, and all of that stuff fell by the wayside after she got elected in the wake of the protests following the heinous death of George Floyd. And it was heinous. And there have been other such incidents that have been heinous. I feel like we shouldn't deny, the need for improvements in policing. And there's a code of silence in our police department. There have been instances of our city law department withholding evidence from the federal courts in police misconduct, civil lawsuits filed by citizens. You know, no one is claiming that cops are always perfect, but most of them are working hard and are good folks, and their jobs are being made impossible. But as to Lightfoot and her anti-corruption agenda, it all fell by the wayside. And in the wake of George Floyd and in the wake of COVID, she used those two things and race as an excuse for dropping all of her clean government proposals. And that's a big part of what this city needs. We have a deep, deep institutional corruption here. And it's really in a way tied to the lenience toward crime, because here's the common denominator, Jane. What we say in Chicago is, don't get caught.
Yeah.
And that goes whether you're an alderman, you know, getting a kickback on a contract that you're helping to enact, or whether you're a guy doing, a dozen carjackings every year, which, by the way, carjackings, which is an awful, horrible crime that changes life forever. For the victims, imagine some guys boxing you in when you're sitting in your car, scrolling on your phone, waiting for your spouse or friend to come out of a building, right? And all of a sudden you're boxed in by two cars out in the street. You're at the curb and they come at you with guns drawn and say, get out of the car. Oh, and by the way, give me your phone and your wallet. And that happens. And it was thought that at first this was just, you know, a way to impress other people in your gang. Now it turns out a lot of the carjack cars are going to chop shops. So now it's a way of making your bones, you know, and they're all like 15, 16 years old. So they're never prosecuted. or at least a great many of them are, not all of the carjackers. So, you know, there's just a whole lot of dark stuff going on. And the main thing is not to get caught. And so you don't get caught most of the time. One corruption expert told me for every one politician that is caught, 10 more aren't. And what we see now, and I can give you some actual numbers from the city of Chicago. So as of last week, we had 1,460 carjackings here, right? Which was up, this is according to Chicago police statistics, 40% higher than last year and 197% higher than the year of 2019. So with nearly 1,500 carjackings, guess how many arrests had been made as of last week? 244. In other words, only one out of every six carjackings does someone get caught. So nobody gets caught for anything here. So it's all about getting away with stuff. So that's really sort of a low form of existence, but it's our way of life here.
Now, I understand that in your vaccine mandate, because you have one like we all do in liberally run cities, that the judge blocked it, that city workers right now do not have to have that. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there was a ruling issued today by a Cook County judge that went to only the mandate directed toward police. And it turned out the issue was collective bargaining. In other words, they've got an existing labor contract with the city, and it turns out that it has provisions in it that the judge thought were important, provisions that say anything like a vaccine mandate that the city is now successfully imposing on its non-police employees. It just so happens the police contract is a little beefier in favor of the unionized employees on stuff like this. So it would have to go to arbitration for the police. So they now, because of this ruling, cannot be fired for failing to get vaccinated. They still have to comply with some other stuff. So it's like actually half a loaf for each side. They still have to get tested two times weekly for COVID, and they still have to report their vaccine status. And some of them are choosing not to. About 27% of officers have not yet reported their vaccine status. About 60% of them have been vaccinated. Other departments are much, much higher. Most other departments, it's like 9 out of 10. Employees have been vaccinated. So, you know, it's certainly a partial victory, but it appears, and I dug into this a little bit, Jane, to try and be prepared to discuss this tonight. It turns out around the country, it's not going really great in the courts for, you know, groups of employees who are trying to fight back against vaccine mandates. But for public employees, it looks like they're at least going to have to submit to very frequent testing and vax status reporting if they choose not to get the vaccine. And it looks like a great many employee groups in the private sector and public sector are basically being compelled to get the vaccine. So it's not a clear-cut win, I would say, for people, you know, asserting freedom to choose and so forth.
Yeah, but like, with all these cities that are in this turmoil already, before this. And now you've got 20%, 25%, maybe even more percent of your police aren't going to be at work because of these vaccine mandates, or it's half a victory. You got Chicago, you've got all these things going on. Drive-by shootings have been going on so long, it's like normal in Chicago. It's not even, people aren't even surprised anymore. You've got these carjackings. I mean, the horror you describe, Matt, of sitting in your car and having people come up with a gun. And I mean, that's just astounding. And that there's no police to call. They're not going to come.
Well,
if they come, they're going to come way too late.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, we're coming for you. That's the message. And that is really where my thinking goes, looking at this story. And, you know, let's not debate whether it's right or wrong for currently 27% of Chicago cops to not want to report their vaccine status. Without saying I agree with their mindset, I think I can say I understand it. They don't want to be compelled. They don't want to be forced by a government that employs them to do a very tough job. They don't want to be forced. They want to have freedom to choose.
Right.
I get that. And here's the thing. Yes, you're exactly right. If this leads to more cops leaving the force, that puts us in a much worse spot. And we're already low. They've already been leaving in great numbers anyway, and not just in Chicago at all. In Portland, as you know, in Seattle, in New York City, in Chicago, in loads of other medium-sized and large cities, police have been leaving because the environment for policing has become very hostile. Almost any time they do their job, if it, you know, involves use of force against anyone of color, they're going to be labeled racist first. They're going to be disciplined first and have to fight their way out of a hole second. And they know that. And so they're leaving for smaller town police forces, for county police forces, and for the state police. And so the cities that need police protection the most, particularly from experienced cops, they're getting less and less of it. And combined with a court system in a city like Chicago or New York, San Francisco, Philadelphia, Portland or Seattle, a court system that has turned into, you know, a revolving door almost totally, you know, it is giving the green light. It's saying you can get away with this.
And yeah, so, but how fed up are the people of Chicago? Because to me, it seems in Portland, there are people that are disgruntled, but there's not a groundswell of rage and do something about this. We deserve to be protected. Our entire task force of people that deal with crowd control, rapid response team, they all quit. All of them.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of them is on there anymore. So that they were highly trained. They were out there. They just weren't backed by the city council. They weren't backed by anybody when they went out and put their life and limb online. So they just decided, we've had it. We quit and did exactly what you just outlined. So, but when does it get to the point, because it hasn't happened here in Portland, that people go, enough is enough. Do they do it by, you know, walking away, or do they do it by standing there and demanding more from their elected officials and support of their police? What do they do?
I'd say right now, well, it's interesting. It's got layers to it. A lot of them do it by walking away, but it depends, frankly, or at least you can break it down ethnically. So, for instance, white and black population each have dropped 33%. Between the 1980 census and the 2020 census in Chicago. So let me say that again so we make sure they heard it. One third population decline in Chicago over the last 40 years for whites and blacks. However, guess how much the Latino population grew over 40 years? 94%. Asian population is up too. So there are various ways to get through it and get past it. So one is to leave town entirely. Another, and we do this in Seattle, we see the police response, you know, dialing down to nearly zero in Seattle. We see the county prosecutor there declining to prosecute car thefts. We see a candidate who may win tomorrow for city attorney who basically wants to abolish, you know, the entire city court system. And a Republican is running against that candidate, so that'll be an interesting race to watch. And what some people do if they don't leave, and they do, you know, they're moving to, you know, Stanley, Idaho, to the beautiful Sawtooth Mountains, you know, they're moving to Montana, they're moving to Eastern Washington, they're moving all kinds of places. But if you don't do that, I can tell you what my wife and I have done. You know, you've got a home, say, in the outer precincts of the city. You're still in the city proper, but you're not downtown in the no-go zone. You know, you see those motor homes that have turned into meth dealing hubs parked at the fringes of your neighborhood.
Everywhere.
But they're
everywhere,
not,
right.
Yeah. Oh, and that's really something, too. And but, you know, they're not in your neighborhood. Your neighborhood is still nice, right? Not much ever happens there that's bad. So you keep your fingers crossed. You keep your eyes open. And, you know, you make sure to lock the door at night and you go on living your life. And you go hiking and you raise your kids and you work hard and make the best out of the rest of life. And you still might have a good life, but you're tuned out. You vote, but nothing ever really changes. And you know it's that way. And you say to yourself, you know what? Eventually, we're going to get out of this place because I'm getting sick of the politics, but I can handle it for a few more years. And here's the thing. In the meantime, young people are moving there, you know, from Caltech, from MIT, from Berkeley, you know, with degrees in computer science, and the politics of white liberal guilt are just fine with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making, you know, $150,000 a year at the age of 23, you know, to be a coder for Amazon.
Right.
So it's all hunky-dory to them. And there's four Thai restaurants around the corner from their fancy apartment that rents for, you know, $2,800 a month for a one bedroom. It's all good to these folks. So you're getting this bifurcation, and you see this in Chicago. The number of census tracts that are upper income and lower income have grown greatly. You know who's leaving. It's the middle class. So we have a hollowing out of the middle class in our big cities. And so that kind of tends to go along with, you know, this rinse and repeat political cycle where the ineffective far-left political leaders keep getting reelected. A lot of the lower-income people don't see any point in voting. And
right.
For a lot of the upper-income people who are feeling guilty about being white and making good money, why, it's just perfect to vote for race-baiting Marxist politicians, you know? So, like I said, you know, I think the success strategy for urban progressives, the political success strategy, is policy failure. It's just perfect.
Yeah, it is. It is more miserable. Yeah. The situation is, the more power they get, the more people are going to drop out and not participate, and that more of them are going to get more control, and it's going to get bleaker. And you know, if our kids are being indoctrinated in schools, that's what to me is so amazing about this Let's Go Brandon movement. Those came out of colleges where those kids have been indoctrinated with all this politically correct racism of wokeness for a long time. And all of a sudden, that's where this came from. It sort of gives me some that these people are they're fed up. There's a little bit of a rebellion going on out there, and they just want to be, you know, young college kids going to have a good time at a football game. They still sort of do that kind of thing, and instead of watching all this misery and suffering. But I just, it going to take some leadership. And right now, I just don't see it. What's going to happen from your eyes looking outward as mine looking far to the other side of the country? What's going to happen in Virginia?
Well, I'd have to say it's a toss-up. I'd say it's remarkable that Glenn Youngkin has gotten to where he is within such close striking distance. And so I can't crystal ball it, but I will say even if Youngkin loses, it's going to be by the thinnest of margins, and it's going to be a huge wake-up call to the Democrats for the senatorial and congressional elections next year. And also, I would say you ask a crucial question about, you know, when will cities reach the breaking point? You note some of the young conservatives in colleges expressing a breaking point in their own way. Let's not forget New York City. I wanted to make sure and mention that tomorrow, almost certainly a strong, important, and I think, you know, good leader, a centrist Democrat named Eric Adams will be elected mayor, barring some sort of, you know, freakishly unexpected turn of events, you know. And I'm not dissing Curtis Sliwa, the Republican candidate. I don't know a lot about him, but he goes way back. He's got more street cred than anybody out there with all his work on behalf of the Guardian Angels, which he founded. So I tip my hat to that guy. But the politics in New York City being what they are, I think is virtually a foregone conclusion. Eric Adams is going to win. Well, let's remember the contrast between a guy like Eric Adams and Bill de Blasio, but also Eric Adams and the three or four very liberal candidates who ran against him in the Democratic primary. He beat them all. And yeah. I think it wasn't Upper West Side Manhattan voters. It wasn't those guilty white liberals who put Adams over. It was the working class voters in the Bronx and the Queens. And some of, you know, Staten Island. So I think that's where the hope lies. If there is to be a moment when Chicago or Portland says, you know, basta, right? Enough. It's going to have to happen in communities of color. And the people that say things to each other in church or at the corner store, you know, where those conservative values are expressed, it's going to have to translate into, you know, greater voter turnout and better candidates and better campaigns. Because right now it's just like who can signal the most in the old-fashioned ways. You know, who's going to be the race warrior, the victimization warrior, the social justice exemplar? Who's going to mouth all those comfortable platitudes? Who's going to do it more convincingly than the rest? And somebody's going to have to start to campaign in a new way. So, you know, Adams, to some limited degree at least, did that in New York. He's in favor of school choice. He wants to let policemen be police at the same time that he wants to work on police accountability. So I'd
say
that's reasonable.
I don't think anybody is really opposed to that. I think it's when it's just the police are always the bad guys. And it's good. All right. Your book is called What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off and Native Son. Matt Rosenberg has gone back to Chicago. He wants to be part of the solution. His book defines the problem. I think if you're living in any kind of urban areas, you're going to relate to this, and he gives us ideas on which and how to turn around our cities and save our country, because we're in trouble. We really are in trouble, and something has to break. And right now, it doesn't seem like there's enough. Although I'm hoping something good happens in Virginia. I've got to, you know, Terry McAuliffe canceled his election night party. That's not a good sign.
No, that's interesting. And I should remind your listeners, Jane, that the book is available online only, mainly through Amazon, but also at Barnes & Noble. So you can just search for it at Google, What Next Chicago, Matt Rosenberg, or you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and in the search box, just enter What Next Chicago, and you will find it.
Is it an ebook, too?
Very fast, and it is in ebook form, yeah, Kindle, and also the Barnes & Noble equivalent, which I think is called Nook. Yes, indeed.
It is. All right, well, good luck, and thank you for spending so much time with us tonight, Matt Matt Rosenberg, and this is an interesting read. I think it's important, and he's going back to try to bring some semblance of order to a city he loves, a beautiful city, great restaurants, unbelievable architecture. I love the architecture in Chicago. It's just it's cornucopia of beauty, and it's so sad to see what's going on in my beautiful city, too. It's just it's horrible, and we need to, something has to happen. So good people standing up.
Yes, and as our cities go, Jane, so goes our nation. We cannot afford to give up on these places, and I thank you for talking to me tonight. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. I look forward to the next time, Matt. Thank you. There you have it.
Take care now.
Good read. And get it on Amazon. And you can get it, just by going to Google. What's next, Chicago? And it's Matt Rosenberg. And it's a good read.